You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So, tonight you will meet a freedom fighter, a man who advocates a radical idea he calls soft vengeance, a process of reconciliation of perpetrators, quote, turning knowledge into acknowledgement. Albie Sachs describes the notion of restorative justice as, quote, discovering the humanity of the people who harmed you, the people who did terrible things to you. And Justice Sachs speaks from hard-won experience. His career in human rights activism started at age 17, when as a second-year law student at the University of Cape Town, he took part in the Defiance of Unjust Laws campaign. As an activist lawyer and leading member of the African National Congress, Albie Sachs lost his right arm and the sight in one eye when his car was bombed by agents of South Africa's security forces in 1988. In 1990, he returned home, and as a member of the Constitutional Committee and the National Executive of the African National Congress, took an active part in the negotiations that led to South Africa becoming a constitutional democracy. After the first democratic election in 1994, he was appointed by President Nelson Mandela to serve on the newly established Constitutional Court, where he had a long and distinguished career and is known for several landmark rulings. When presented with the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation Award in 2010, Archbishop Desmond Tutu acknowledged Judge Albie Sachs' contribution to South Africa's transformation from apartheid to democracy via the difficult process of reconciliation. The Institute noted that, despite being devastated by a bomb planted by agents of apartheid, Judge Sachs chose to, quote, move forward to pursue the soft vengeance of the rule of law and reconciliation, a decision that was not taken lightly as reconciliation was not cheap. It is not cheap. Tutu ended, "The success of the urgent struggle for social justice, which requires the participation of all of us, will depend on whether this vision is taken forward or forgotten." Tonight, in conversation with Renee Montaigne, Judge Sachs will talk about his life and work and its implications for our times. In conversation with Albie Sachs tonight is Renee Montaigne, co-host of NPR's Morning Edition. In 1990, and you've all heard Renee's voice in the morning, she was just telling me she gets to work at midnight, so she's up for us, though. I saw her have coffee at dinner. In 1990, Renee traveled to South Africa to cover Nelson Mandela's release from prison and continued to report from South Africa for 3 years. And in 1994, she and a team of NPR reporters won a prestigious Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Award for coverage of South Africa's historic presidential and parliamentary elections. But before Albie and Renee begin their conversation tonight, we have another distinguished guest, and we're delighted to have Roderick Spencer with us tonight, who will read a short excerpt from The Soft Vengeance of a Freedom Fighter, Albie Sachs' memoir. Roderick Spencer is a film producer and writer, and with his wife, Alfre Woodard, they are both co-founders of Artists for a New South Africa, where Roderick is also the board chair. So please join me in welcoming Roderick Spencer, Albie Sachs, and Renee Montaigne to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Good evening. Just very briefly, the context of this excerpt is Albie's reaction to, in the aftermath of being appointed to the Constitutional Court. "Again and again, I heard these words, 'Congratulations, you deserved it. How well meant. And how hurtful all the same. It just was not like that. Had they asked me straight out, do you think it was worth it after suffering the loss you did? I would have answered, no. The idea of my measuring my involvement in the anti-apartheid struggle in terms of personal reward was deeply distressing, apart from the implication that one could be appointed to the court not on the basis of capacity, but for time served. What had given honor and dignity to our lives was precisely the fact that we chose to combat injustice without thought or even hope of receiving personal benefit. The reward was the endeavor, the comradeship, the fervor of human interaction, the sense of living an intensely meaningful life that engaged fully with the world while establishing a distinctive personal space for each one of us. In that sense, we were the most privileged of all human beings in the late 20th century, privileged to have taken part in a struggle animated by the highest ideals of the age. To regard the office at the end of the journey as its validation was to rob it of all of its inherent virtue. Yet, if the same questioner had asked, was it worth it, after all you had been through, to end up tired and strained in an anonymous voting queue and be one of 20 million people making a cross on a piece of paper, I would have answered, yes, yes, yes. The reward was the journey itself. The ineffably rich human encounters on the way, the manner in which we evolved, so interesting, so full of surprise, so challenging emotionally and intellectually, as we've led 3, 4, 5, 6 lives in one. We dared everything, had views on art, science, the origin of the universe, the nature of history, the destiny of humanity, everything tied up. Once you invested your life in belief, everything that touched on that belief became meaningful. Our love, our anger, our romanticism, our fantasies all had a special intensity. We were not somnambulists meandering vacuously through life, but human beings incandescent with purpose. Many of the ideas that gave us strength turned out to be based on lies and cruelty. At times, our individual personalities got confused and bruised in the collective. We suppressed real sides of ourselves in the name of an abstract greater good. We were often incapable of expressing personal love or enjoying beauty for their own sakes. We could act with the arrogant self-confidence of the self-nominated agents of history. We had as many personal disasters and heartbreaks as anyone else, at times even more. Yet there was always that distinctive experience of participating, body and spirit, in something meaningful. The sense of engaging with the deep passions of society, of being linked to something intensely virtuous, of overcoming the barriers that kept human beings apart, of responding to and joining in the deep music of African humanity. Finally, at the end of it all, or rather at the close of the particular stage that had overwhelmingly occupied our lives, we were accomplishing our goal of living in a free, non-racial, and democratic country. This was what made sense of our lives and justified everything. This was the meaningful reward to which we felt entitled. This, and not attaining office, was our soft vengeance.
I think I gather that quite a number of the people in this room were blessed to be able to mark that cross on the ballot, either here in Los Angeles or back in South Africa. I think we have a lot of South Africans in the room. or children of. I was blessed to be able to be in the middle of the country in a little town, Zastron, and we literally picked the middle of the country, and I drove from Cape Town to be in that place to watch, as it turns out, the lines that started before dawn and stretched from, it seemed like miles, probably wasn't miles, but stretched for this little town for quite a ways, and watch people, as we all remember it, mixed up, black and white, and waiting. Everyone had to wait, and they had to wait together. And it was a long wait, and it was sort of wonderful that it was long, because people had waited so long for this moment. So I as Roderick read Albee's writing, I heard the words meaningful life, which you speak of often, and we all want to have meaningful lives, but you have made a special you are a special definition of the of going about how to go about doing that. So if you don't mind, I'd like to start in a way from the beginning, from Luis mentioned the 17-year-old who embarked on a journey that I imagine you didn't quite have really a really good sense of what it was, where it was going to take you. When you first, what was it exactly? What was the protest? What was it? Was a sitting, right?
Just before we forget the voting.
Yeah.
Since you mentioned it, standing in a line, we'd spent our whole lives fighting for freedom in our lifetime. My boy, Africa. That was the slogan. And now that moment has come, and I expected to feel ecstatic. And I'm standing in that line, and it's moving slowly. And I'm thinking, these people, it was in Camps Bay, wealthy people. I'm thinking to myself, I couldn't help it, what's going on here? They did nothing. They did nothing for the struggle. And their vote counts for just as much as mine. And in a way, it was the most humbling, shocking experience of what democracy means.
Mm.
You know, on that day, we were truly all equal. Whether you were a prison warder or somebody who'd been in the struggle, one person, one vote. That was fantastic. But when we started in 17, I was 17, a lot of people asked me afterwards, how come you're so interested in culture and you brought culture into the struggle and so on? And I explained it was the other way around. My first year at university, I came from very activist parents. It was my mother's milk, my dad's voice. But I didn't want to feel I'm just following in their footsteps. And so I kind of turned my back a little bit on the expectations that they had, the automatic ones. And then my mom said, there's a poet called Ace Krecker who's going to give a lecture on a Spanish writer called Federico Lorca. Poets in Spain? They had bullfights in Spain. I didn't even know they had poets in Spain. Poets wrote in English. We learned them at school. Any event, I went. And this little guy, very liberated Afrikaner, and he's walking up and down, and he explains Lorca in the 30s, eventually picked up by the fascists, executed. It was so dramatic. It was so powerful. And he quoted the Neruda poem, Los a los cinco de la tarde, at five in the afternoon. And what that occasion did for me was it linked up all the private inwardness of poetry, of dreaming, of imagining the world and how you fit it in the world with the big public events. And poetry made the connection. It was poetry that got me into politics. I didn't bring poetry into politics, poetry got me into politics. And a few weeks later, I was in the Modern Youth Society, and a few months later, I was sitting on a bench marked non-whites only, as a small group of white people joining in overwhelmingly black movement to defy the unjust laws. So from the beginning, the idea was something big, a total transformation. We even used the word revolution, because we couldn't see change in South Africa coming about in any other way. The idea of me being a judge, now that was totally unexpected and totally inconceivable.
Of course, the judge, you went through, obviously, many, many incarnations in a way before you reached the moment that, you know, in this book, of course, it was written originally, it was written in 1988, 89. It was right after the attack on you that left you without an arm. And it was before everything happened. So you had certain expectations about how the world was going to go after so much struggle. But let me just ask you, I think everybody would be interested. You were in jail. You were imprisoned, solitary confinement. How did that happen?
It was called the 90 days law. You could be plucked out of your office from the street, thrown into prison for 90 days in solitary confinement. If they suspected you had information about people who were plotting against the state, and thousands of us were arrested. This was after Sharpeville, a very critical time in South Africa. And many of my clients had been picked up. They just like vanished. And being a lawyer didn't protect you from that. And the next thing I know, six, they all seemed to be very huge and very big. And like you see in the movies, people reading a newspaper, somebody bending down, suddenly they spring into action, they surround you. They were waiting for me to come into my office, and the next thing I'm locked up. And we used to read literature about people who'd been imprisoned in the resistance, tortured. And my first thought is, so this is what it's like. And I'm in a concrete cube, and I'm trying to be brave, and I'm just alone. It's a whole long, long story. We've only got an hour or so. Yeah. So I won't take you through it. But one part I do, or two things that I would like to mention. One was one of the techniques I used to keep myself in touch with myself. And it was much worse than I expected. And all the big ideas about freedom and liberation meant nothing. You're just locked up in a tiny space. You don't quite know why you're there. You're very, very confused in yourself, and there's just some inner spirit that kind of keeps you going, resisting, cooperating with the others. And I would sing different songs, and I would start with the alphabet, Always, Because, Charmaine, the hit songs of 1963. And I might mention, for a while, I was the only person in the whole world who didn't know Kennedy had been assassinated for 3 days. And then the interrogators were so excited to find somebody who didn't know, they came specially to see me. Have you heard that President Kennedy's assassinated? What? And his killer's been killed. What? And I was really kind of terrified after that. But just to give you some idea of how complete it was. Any event, so I would sing, and my favorite song was Always. I'll be living here. Always, year after year, always, in this little cell that I know so well, I'll be living swell, always, always. And I would twirl around and I'd feel kind of amused that Noel Coward had used the song in Blithe Spirit, this comedy of upper middle class manners in England, was keeping this freedom fighter in South Africa in good revolutionary spirit. I'll be staying in always, keeping up my chin always, not for but an hour, not for but a week, not for 90 days, but always.
Well, it wasn't for 90 days either. It was longer than that. Yes, enough time to drive someone mad.
Released actually. For a few minutes and then re-detained again. And then the other thing while I'm on music was jail is just awful. You don't see anybody, you don't speak to anybody, but you hear sounds of people crying and doors slamming and commands. And then one day I hear some whistling. And that doesn't sound like jail music. And then I'm listening and listening. And then I whistle back. I don't know who it is. And then I hear a response. And I try out all my ANC tunes and there's no response. And eventually, the Dvorak going home theme.
Yeah.
and somebody whistles back. To this day, when I hear that music, I get goose flesh. It was a tiny point. I didn't know who it was, and I only found out months after I was released that somebody else had been locked up elsewhere in the prison. These are the, if you like, the lighter moments. They were when I was in good form, I was depressed. Just to be depressed was being okay. And then it was like deep, deep sense of despair. And maybe if the interrogators had timed the interventions better, you know, maybe that I would have cracked. But we're in a library now.
Yeah.
And the only book I was allowed was the Bible. And I would read it 3 pages every day, disciplining myself in case I'm in for months. And it was in the columns running down. And I'm reading through for the first time in my life from beginning to end. And I'm furious with my colleagues. I'm an advocate. In broad daylight, I'm thrown into prison. No lawyer, no trial, no contact with families. We speak about brutal, it's terrible. And a rage against my colleagues and against the legal profession. One day the station commander comes in, he's waving a piece of paper. If they'd listened to me, this would never have happened. And I read it, and my eye can't go across the page. My eye's going down in columns. But eventually I force, and I see it in the Supreme Court of South Africa, Cape of Good Hope Provincial Division, the case of Sachs versus Rousseau. Oh, Sachs, that's me. And it's hereby ordered that the applicant be given access to reading matter and writing material. I want to jump up for joy, but they mustn't see your emotions. And now suddenly the law is the most wonderful thing in the whole world that's ever been invented. But then how do I get reading material? And the first thing given to me was the Police Gazette. But I was so eager to read anything. And then I said, well, my friends can send in literature. Oh, no. They will prick the words to pass messages in code. So the understanding was that I would write on a piece of paper the books I wanted to see, and they would take it to the local library. And I used to imagine the librarian, a young police officer who can barely speak English, coming in and asking for a copy of Remembrance of Things Past by Proust, which, by the way, I wasn't able to read. I needed action, I needed visceral, I needed something interactive. And the two books that I lodged so deeply in my mind, and I read in this extraordinary circumstance, no one to speak to, just the library sending me books, and the one was Moby Dick. And what a marvelous, fantastic book, and the drama of it, and the story of it, and there I was, just completely open to this epic tale with so much interest and detail and humanity. And the other was Don Quixote. And I'd never read it right through. And the second portion of that book, after Cervantes himself had been in jail, it's not this crazy guy on his horse saving somebody who doesn't even know exists and doesn't want to be saved by him. It's the idealist on his horse. And he's going off to do battle for justice, and he gets knocked down, and he's in the dust, and he's lying there, and Sancho Panza picks him up. He's on his horse, and he goes and gallops off again, and he's knocked down again. That was me. That was me. And I've never felt the connection with literature. I never felt the lifeline to a library. It's not the normal lending process that libraries go in for. And I told this story at an international conference of librarians in Durban. And people knew who the librarian was, and they got in touch with him, but he died before I ever met him.
Oh,
but, you know, I owe... That's one reason why I was so thrilled when I was asked to speak here. In a sense, there are so many people in the world for whom the libraries are the lifelines to a world of imagination, a world of poetry, a world where things happen that you can't have in your own life, but you can connect up with and you can live. You can live through the pages and through the imagination of the authors in ways that you can't do yourself, but you can start imagining for yourself. So thank you. Thank you, Library of Los Angeles. And the stories I've been hearing about this library makes it so special that you've got outlets all over the city and that each outlet is not just a place for books, but it's a place where people meet and they feel safe and they interact with each other and they get health education and they have fun and so on. So truly, thank you to the Los Angeles Library and thank you to Aloud. And I'd like everybody to give the organizers some applause.
I hadn't known that story, but it's a lovely story. And just I just have to put in one small thing. And I have my two favorite New Yorker cartoons. I've got pinned. They're all yellow now and what. Pinned to a bulletin board above my desk. And one of them, it's a man standing. Well, you know how those cartoons are, right? So you can imagine it. You know, it's a man standing. There's a guard behind him, and then he's standing in front of an open cell, jail door, and the caption is, "I forgot my book." It's like for the rest of his life, right? That's a little bit. Well, you know, one thing about this book, which is it is almost entirely devoted. Well, it's devoted to an amazing layers and layers of philosophy, but the plot, if you will, it has to do with the attack that was meant to kill you, that obviously didn't come close to that. In fact, as you even say, it gave you a new life in so many ways, and one of them being physical, interestingly enough. But threading through it are all these jokes, and they're kind of bad jokes, actually. They're not very literary at all. And there's one that finds its way all through the whole thing, and you just have to tell it. Or tell the story that led up to it, except the story is, of course, terribly awful, but you don't have to tell the joke now, but it's about Jaime Cohen. I know, again, I want to move on to the very serious things, but this is very serious, and it's very much who you are, and how can you be dying, practically, and be thinking of this sort of outrageous
joke?
I don't know.
Well, let me tell the joke. I mean, everything goes totally dark, and I know something terrible is happening to me. If I'm alive, I don't know. If I'm dead, I don't know. And I hear a voice after a while, and it says, "Albie, this is Eva Garrido speaking to you. You're in Maputo Central Hospital. Your arm is in lamentable condition. You must face the future with courage." And I said, "What happened?" And a woman's voice said, "It was a car bomb." I fainted back into obscurity, but with a sense of delirium. That moment every freedom fighter is waiting for. Will they come for me today, tonight, tomorrow? If they do, will I survive? Will I be brave? They'd come for me, and I'd got through. And I just felt a huge surge of joy, and then total darkness. And then I come to, and I'm lying flat on my back. I can't see anything, but I'm feeling very light. And I tell myself the joke about Jaime Cohen. I'm told in America it would be Jaime Goldberg. it's the same person about a joke. It's an old joke. Some of you will know it. And he falls off a bus, and he gets up, and he does this. And his friend said, "Jaime, I didn't know you were Catholic. What do you mean Catholic?" "Spectacles, testicles, wallet, and watch."
Just checking.
And for some reason, I started with testicles. And I have tried all my life to be macho without any success. Became hugely popular in the camps, the ANC camps. And the first thing Comrade Albie did was reach for his balls. Seemed to be all in order. Wallet, my heart is okay. I feel my head. That could be serious. And there's a crater, but it seems okay. My hand slides down. Watch, it's only an arm. And I felt fantastic. I was going to say, don't ask me why, but you've just asked me why. I don't know. But humor played a huge role in our struggle. It's part of what's called the South African miracle. We never lost it. And humor and humanity kind of go together. In my case, the humor came from being a Jew, the Jewish humor, the Yiddish humor, dealing with oppression, warding off oppression through a joke, often jokes told against yourself. And certainly I didn't have a chance to prepare that joke. It just came to me. And it was fantastic. And I don't recommend this as a cure for... No, as a cure for overcoming all the problems of your life. But somehow, honestly, it worked that way. It blasted away all the things that had made me miserable and downcast and overcome by petty little preoccupations. And from then onwards, that was April the 7th, 1988, my life has just been, you know, soaring all the time.
You know, you just said something, the South African miracle. And I think now, in this moment in time, there's been other moments like this, but the Arab Spring, Syria, revolutions that we've seen that, you know, have turned terribly, terribly dark. And South Africa remains, it turns out, decades later, to be not quite a one-off, but as revolutions go, pretty close. But do you? It's not a miracle, though, really.
Because no, it's not. Because, you know, we had so many meetings. I used to think freedom meant no more meetings. It was all wrong. And miracles aren't made of minutes and matters arising in any other business. Even in the underground, we used to have minutes, matters arising in any other business. Can you imagine? So there was nothing more purposed. Nothing more intentional, nothing more thought about, nothing more intended than our transformation in South Africa. But it had the feeling of a miracle, and no one gave us a chance. And yet we managed, because we really needed each other in South Africa. The interdependence wasn't just moral. It wasn't just being nice to people who'd been enemies before. It actually made a lot of sense. And our big dream, and it was so strong with Oliver Tambo in particular, the whites were never generous enough and open enough and embracing enough to imagine a country that belonged to everything, everybody. We Africans who've suffered so much, we can prove to ourselves and to the whites and to the world, black and white can live together in one country. That was a goal. It was an intended objective. And we got it through the Constitution very much, through bringing the fighting to an end, through looking into each other's eyes. It lasted 6 years just making the Constitution. Miracles shouldn't last 6 years. but what I find kind of impressive for us now, because there are a lot of things happening in South Africa now that are not acceptable. And I say sometimes we shoot ourselves in the foot so often we've run out of feet to shoot ourselves in. But there's something solid and substantial there. And you compare it with Egypt, fantastic change, a year later, the elected prime minister's in jail, 1,000 people shot dead. And we can have elections next year, and they're free and fair, and people come to witness the elections to see what lessons they can take to other countries. Our president steps down. We have a press that's very lively, and if there are any threats to the press, you'll know within 25 seconds, because the press will tell you, and that's good. We have a very robust independent judiciary. So we've got the institutions. We haven't got the economy working the way we want to. We haven't got the employment. We have too much corruption, too much crime. There are lots of negatives. But there's something that we've achieved and that we've planted there that I think is enduring.
But you know, I do wonder, in the epilogue to this book, which actually I read the book, but I just read the epilogue, which was actually 2000. I mean, it was a long time ago that you wrote this. But you wrote then that, and I'm quoting you, "We're far from achieving the boring society of our dreams." At that point, meaning it was still, I mean, there were still many issues, you know, there many things. But I'm wondering now if, do you think that's still true now? This is 12, 13 years later. I mean, in a way, has it calm down and not always in a good way, to where it...
Okay, there are two completely separate things here. One is the paradox of our years of struggle mm-hmm. was we were fighting with all our passion to create a boring society. And it was amazing actually hearing Roderick saying those things. Did I say that? Wow, that's beautiful. But it really represented the culmination of a whole long period of life. And it was almost like not a requiem, but a closing note to that epic period of intense struggle where you put yourself on the line. And we didn't want to live in a country where you have to put yourself on the line and be ready to give your life and ready to go to jail and withstand torture. We didn't want that. We wanted a more boring society like, but I won't mention any names. So that is an achievement. And when people ask me what advice would I give to young people today, then I say the only advice I give you is don't listen to the advice of people like me. But that's a bit of a trap, because if they don't listen to me, if they listen to me, they won't listen to me. That can go on endlessly. Now, but for them to be as cheeky and irreverent and challenging and daring and curious about the world as we were, that's what I look forward to. And I think we have achieved a society where that is possible. Then there's lots of things that are negative, that are lousy. But if we didn't have the institutions that enabled us to deal with them, if the lousiness was somehow entrenched into the very structure of the society, then I would be more worried than I am now. We do have freedom of speech. We do have freedom to organize. We can protest. We can bring about change. There's a lot of vitality in South Africa. And I think that vitality will win through. I'm beginning to sound like I'm asking for somebody to vote for me.
Well, you know, that I wonder, we've been hearing lately about the born freeze. You know, black South Africans born either just before or after the 1994 elections. Is that a story that's been overblown? I mean, or is it something you recognize? Young people who really don't care about politics and they care more about their cell phone or their video game.
I think they care about their cell phones a lot of the time, and they care about politics, and they care about love, and they care about the things and the date and that young people, you know, everywhere care about. I think it's over-dramatized to quite a large extent. They care about getting a job. They debate, they argue. They will vote. Millions of them will vote. So I think it's oversimplified to simply say the born freeze, they're uninterested, they're apathetic. But I hope they're different from us. We were driven. We were driven, but we were driven by the necessity of living in a starkly, terribly unjust society with cruelty all around us, written into the nature of the Constitution. And the freedom we were fighting for was the freedom for them to be politically engaged if they wanted, to be on their cell phones if they wanted. Those are their choices.
Take us back to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. First of all, in its time, it wasn't in South Africa, as I remember, because I was there in 96 and 97, too, it wasn't necessarily so embraced, the way the rest of the world thought it was amazing and wonderful, and it was, in my opinion, but not everybody thought that. I mean, some people thought this was not right. I mean, the more innocent people were the ones that were coming forward, and, you know, black people were coming forward, and not so many, you know, the oppressed were coming forward, the oppressors not so much, that sort of thing. But you had a personal experience, which is, say, you were attacked, and you were attacked by the state. What was your feeling about... Did you yourself want to face your attacker, hear his story, know what he was thinking?
All right, hear my story. And I'm sitting as Judge Albie Sachs in my chambers, the phone rings, and it's reception here. There's a man called Henry who says he has an appointment to meet you, and I said, send him through. Oh, it's going boom, 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 boom. I walked down the corridor. Henry had phoned to say he had organized the planting of the bomb in my car. He's going to the Truth Commission. Am I willing to meet him? And I opened the security door, and there's Henry. Tall, thin like myself, a bit younger than me. And he's looking at me, I'm looking at him. And I think this is the man who tried to kill me. And I see in his eyes, this is the man I tried to kill. We hadn't known each other. We hadn't fought over money, love, a job. But he tried to kill me, and there he was. And he was on that side, I was on this side. We walked down, and he's striding like a soldier, and I try my best judge's ambulation to slow him down. And we get into my office, we talk, and eventually I stand up and say, Henry, I have to get on with my work. And normally when I say goodbye to somebody, I shake that person's hand. I can't shake your hand. But go to the Truth Commission, maybe we'll meet one day. And I remember when we walked back, he was going along shuffling like a defeated soldier, and I forgot about him. And about 9 months later, I'm at a party, end of year, the band is playing loudly, I'm with a friend, and we work very, very, very hard as judges, and I want to relax, and I hear a voice saying, Albie, my God, it's Henry, and he's beaming, and he comes up to me, and we get into a corner, and he says, and you told me, I went to Bobby and Sue and Farouk, the people who are in exile with me, and I told them everything, and you said that maybe one day, and I said, Henry, I've only got your face to tell me what you're saying is the truth. And I put out my hand, and I shook his hand. He walked away, almost flying out, almost fainted. But I heard afterwards, he suddenly left the party, went home, and he cried for 2 weeks. And that moved me very much. Henry's not my friend. I won't phone him up and say, let's go to a movie. But if I'm sitting in a bus, and he sits down next to me, I say, oh, Henry, how are you getting on? And I might mention, a film has just been made called Soft Vengeance, L.B. Sachs in the New South Africa. And I suggested they might like to interview Henry. So I haven't seen him since then. And I've seen him on the rough cut of the film. And it's quite fascinating for me to hear how he speaks about putting the bomb in the car and how he thinks about what's happened. And I mention that story because it was good for me. Instead of the enemy being that blind force trying to exterminate me, it was this guy, Henry, who had had at least the spirit to go to the Truth Commission, to come and meet me and to look into my eyes. And the strength of the Truth Commission was, it was real human beings going up and talking. We saw them on the TV. We heard the tears of those who'd suffered. We saw the stiff body language of those who'd done the torturing. We heard from the ANC people who'd done bad things. We did bad things. And I think it had an enormous impact in our country. It didn't transform our country. That can only happen when everybody really has equal chances in life, and that's, we're still working at that. But it opened up some of the worst of the sores, and people were able to recover the bodies of their children and their parents who died to give them a decent funeral. And we got lots of information, and you mentioned that phrase, from knowledge to acknowledgement. Knowledge, everybody knew bad things had happened. That's data, statistics. Acknowledgement is, what did it mean? Where was I? What was I doing? Why didn't I take a stand? How can we stop these things from happening again? What would I have done in those circumstances? And in that sense, the psychological impact on our nation was enormous. And so I'm a very strong supporter in retrospect and at the time of the Truth Commission process. But I acknowledge also that it's very contested. But if people feel the Truth Commission alone was going to make everybody love everybody in South Africa, that's totally unrealistic. It just swept away some of the worst of the pain. The most hidden, ugly, atrocious things that had happened came out to the open. And at least it unblocked the way for us to take the steps that are needed to deal with the very, very hard problems of still continuing injustice in our society.
One thing, though, that I always say to people when this ever comes up about the transformation or the transition, at least, of South Africa to a one-man, one-vote democracy, is that there's a great deal of forgiveness in the culture and in amongst black South Africans in particular. But I'm an outsider. Do you think I'm seeing something that's correct?
I don't use the word forgiveness. I was at a jazz club. It's called Rosie's and All That Jazz, wonderful jazz club in Cape Town. And the owner was an Afrikaans-speaking guy, one of the joint owners, and he came up and said, "Verskoon me, forgive me." And I tried to answer in Afrikaans, but Portuguese came into my head. And I said, "Don't ask me, ask the... You know, I'm helping to create a new constitution. This is fantastic. Maybe ask the people, the little-known people in the townships, ask them for forgiveness, not me, because I look like you and I have the same skin color as yourself." But I said, "This club is your forgiveness." He was doing something positive. I was sorry afterwards. He was sitting over there. I was sitting here. I should have just given him an embrace. I shouldn't have philosophized it. I shouldn't have gone into. But I think for Archbishop Tutu, the theme of forgiveness was important. He came from a Christian confessional position, and you forgive something, you get it, the rancor and the wrath out of your own heart, and you can move on, and you can meet each other. For me, it was more transcending. Partly in our movement, we believed it's the system that's bad. You change the system, and people, even the oppressors, are trapped in the system. And you change the system of oppression, then people can free themselves. And we did see a lot of that. And it's wonderful, actually, when you see people struggling to discover their own humanity. So it wasn't just us finding the humanity in the oppressors, enabling the oppressors to find humanity in themselves. And you do that not just through abstract talking and moralizing. You do that through working together to solve problems. And when we got the new constitution, I mean, I often say, we South Africans are fantastic at miracles. We're not so good at the ordinary. And now we're battling with doing the ordinary and the mundane. And that, in that sense, was the miracle of looking into each other's eyes and working and working and working and finding the right language and getting this very, very beautiful constitution.
But what for you is people have their favorite parts, as we know in America, of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, for the most part, the First Amendment. There are lots of people who like the Second. is there something in the Constitution that just rises and shines for you?
The whole of the first part, the preamble. South Africa belongs to all who live in it. In a sense, that says it all. And then the recognizing the sacrifices of people who struggle to bring about the change, that's in the preamble. We acknowledge in the history, you don't say these things didn't happen. The non-racial, non-sexist society, I fought so hard for that word non-sexist in a little... little group, all men, and it was three white men and me. I don't include myself amongst the white men. And two African men in that little drafting group. And I insisted, the women in our struggle had fought so hard, and they'd fought inside the ANC for dignity and full rights inside the organization, not just in the nation. And I dug in my heels, non-sexist. And the person chairing it said, "I don't understand what this word means." And the other whites joined him, and the two African guys stood by me because they didn't want to see me put down by them. Not that they, you know. And then one of them said, "Our daughters and our mothers really fought hard. Let's support what Albie Sachs said." And then finally, he writes it in an ink. The guy in charge, I won't give his name, some of you from South Africa will know his name, quite a prominent political figure, very, very good guy. And then he says, "Okay, let's get one of the girls to type it." One of the girls, in fact, the typist, and we were very suspicious of the typists, one from the government and one from our side. The one from our side, Janet Love, had been in the underground. There'd been a reward of 100,000 rand for her arrest, for her capture. She was one of the girls. The next night we have the same thing, and he says, "Okay, let's get one of the lassies to type it." And I just gave up. I just gave up.
So
that
trying,
has a special meaning for me. We got the children's rights. That was important. Spelled out quite fully. We had earlier on planned to have rights for women. And we were given hell by Dorothy Driver, who is often referred to as married to Graham Coetzee, the writer, very strong feminist. What's this rights for women? Aren't women voters? Aren't women doing all the things that are in the Constitution? They should be everywhere. We have to look at the Constitution with women's eyes to make sure that every single clause in the Constitution is gender sensitive. So there's no rights for women as such. Workers' rights are quite strong. But in the Equality Clause, it's very comprehensive. And it includes the usual race, color, creed, national origin, birth, disability, and sexual orientation. And what, South Africa? Yes, South Africa. Environmental rights, they are there. It was a moment when, to a certain extent, all the finest hopes and expectations that you felt our country should be pivoted around were incorporated into that document. And then we had to find ways and means of making it meaningful, not just, you know, beautiful paper fantasies, meaningful. And that became my job on the court. It wasn't so easy. We have social and economic rights, the right of access to health care, to adequate to housing, to education. We're fighting for it right on, right on, right on. But now you're a judge up there. How do you make it realizable, implementable without taking over government? And that was our existential moment up there. And I remember in the case of Mrs. Grootboom, who's become quite famous now because she was in a shack and she moved from a very wet area with the kids up to high ground and was evicted from there, ended up with 1,000 of them sleeping out in the open with just a piece of plastic to cover them. And I imagine Mrs. Grootboom lying on the ground at night, her children are sleeping, and she's looking up and asking, why? Why am I lying out in the field like this with my children? I've done nothing bad. What I want is a decent life for them. And there are people not far from here living in beautiful homes. Why? And then my moment up on the bench, how? And it's her why I had to meet our how. And again, it was enthralling as a judge to find ways and means of giving something that was implementable, reasonable measures within available resources, the way we lawyers talk, progressively to realize the rights. And South Africa, that became the most backward country in the world, becoming the most progressive country in the world in terms of enlarging the vision of what the law can do.
I'm just going to follow that and then we'll have questions. But I do have to say, it is quite splendid to have the rights and even have them upheld where they can be. But say if there are worker protections, very strong ones, where there's the right to education, there's a right to the good things in life or a good solid life. What do you think, though, when every day you wake up to a country that has, as the statistics are a little odd, but let's say 46% unemployment amongst some age groups and a whole generation of people who are really having trouble finding jobs?
Well, yes, I mentioned that, and it's serious and it's grievous, but it doesn't mean rights are unimportant. If people didn't have the rights, then they would be suffering the economic hardships and not even have the right to protest, to organize, to complain, the right to paint, sing, dance, express themselves they want, to read what they want, to write, the right to protest, the right to get information, to understand what's happening, the right to vote in elections. So the rights are extremely important. And I think that's one reason why we don't have government pulled down by the army taking over and a million people in the squares, bringing down the government, because people know they do have the rights, and they know it's hard, and they know it takes time to transform your country. And there is a sense of dignity that people have. I'm sure you felt that when you go there. And it's dignity amongst everybody. people doing very, very humble servile jobs, but there's a kind of pride that had to be suppressed before. And that sense of transformation and change, I think, is very real. One can trot out statistics. 2.5 million homes have been given free to people living in shacks, and maybe 10 million people have moved from shacks into brick homes with water, electricity. Water now reaches 90% of the people. Electricity, 90% of the people. That's huge for poor people still living in humble conditions. People are doing things they couldn't do before, but it's still very, very heavy. But the fact that you have the rights, I think, is very meaningful. And you can go to court. And we had the one case, I've just been lecturing to the World Bank. I mentioned afterwards, I don't know if it was my biggest triumph or my greatest capitulation, but I got a standing ovation from the World Bank. If anybody had told me that 20 years ago, I would have said, no, me, never. And I was speaking about social and economic rights. And I told the story about I'm going into court, and I know the court is filled with people wearing T-shirts saying HIV positive, men, women, young, old, black, white, brown. And it's the Treatment Action Campaign case dealing with the provision of nevirapine to women living with a virus about to give birth. And if they take that nevirapine, it cuts the transmission to the baby by 50%. The baby gets a drop afterwards. And the government had said only in 2 sites in each of the 9 provinces can it be done. And we go into court. My colleague Sandile Ngobo says, do you want a hanky, Albie? And I say, no, I'm ready today, I'm okay. And the hanky was 6 months earlier we'd had a case of Mr. Hoffman who'd applied for a job as a steward on South African Airways. And he passed all the tests with flying colors, but he was HIV positive. And they said, sorry, we'll employ you on the ground, but not serving coffee. Our customers will go to British Air that doesn't employ people living with the virus. He went to court. He said it's a denial of his fundamental rights. He lost, came to us. And Sandile Ngobo, who offered me the handkerchief later on, gave an exquisite judgment about the importance of work for human dignity, how you can't allow prejudice to dictate who gets a job, who doesn't get a job. And far from capitulating to prejudice, it's the duty of South African Airways to stand up against the prejudice. And the court was jam-packed with people wearing these T-shirts, and we went out, dead silence, and cheering broke out. And I started crying. And I was crying not because of the impact of HIV in our country, but to feel I'm a member of a court. We can uphold the basic rights of people in ways that we hadn't even imagined. And I told the story at Harvard, and the word got back to Sandile rather crudely that he'd made me cry. So now he's offering me a handkerchief. And the Treatment Action Campaign, it's the same thing. And we say it's unreasonable for the state to refuse to roll out the antiretroviral. Dead silence in the court. We go to the back, the cheering starts, and I cried again. But I mention that to say the law does make a difference. It does give hope. It does mean you have a recourse. You don't have to go out in the street and kill somebody if you want to get your rights. There are channels that can be used. And I'm sure that's one reason why what you call our revolution, our transformation, has remained so stable with all the difficulties that we have. You'd think it's impossible to survive with so much unemployment, with so many problems. And yet there's something in our society, in our institutions that are functioning and working, that remains solid and certainly makes it bearable for me to put up with a lot of things that are really completely unacceptable.
I'd like to open it up to questions. Now, Albie Sachs has an unusual way of taking questions, which we're willing to do, right? We thought it'd be good if maybe 2 or 3 of you, three questions, could be all asked in a bunch. Just and then he's going to jump in and.
Okay, well, first question.
Good evening, sir. Thank you.
Could you please comment on three issues or three items? Could you please share with us the percentage of population that is AIDS infected in South Africa? The second question is, in the last 19 years, what has happened to the financial currency? Has it increased or devalued? Please. And the third question I have is approximately what percentage of elderly minorities have been murdered, raped, or housebroken, or been attacked and brutalized in the last, let's say, 3 months? Thank you.
Okay, that's three questions I'd like from three people.
Yes, that's kind of what we were thinking.
Now, it's partly my answers tend to be long, so I might as well give one long answer to several questions. Anyhow, thank you for those questions.
I'm interested in how your family came to South Africa and when. What was their journey?
I'm just interested in your perceptions of Mandela.
Well,
okay, maybe one more.
Joseph Malema, where does he go and how's that going to affect South Africa in the future?
I used to know the AIDS percentages. I could quote them. And perhaps it's the extent to which the rolling out of antiretrovirals has transformed the mood in the country totally. The treatment action campaign that brought the case to our court was a very extraordinary civil society organization. It was people living with the virus got together. It wasn't an NGO speaking on behalf of suffering people. It was people living with the virus, got together, organized, and HIV doesn't respect class, age, color, wealth. It was attacking many, many people. So it was a very extraordinary body, treatment action campaign. And one consequence of winning their battle against a lot of denialism in our country was that when the rollout started, they were on the ground. And they were able to help with the administration of the antiretrovirals and go to their neighbors and ensure not only that they regularly took the ARVs, but they looked after their nutrition and all the other complementary things that you need to do. And if you want a miracle in South Africa, in a sense, that's the miracle of how despair has been transformed. We still have many, many deaths. It's still awful. It's still hitting us hard. But because of the antiretrovirals and the organization, people are leading very productive lives. And we saw it on our court. Edwin Cameron, who's a very brilliant judge, writes beautifully. When he was nominated for the court, he said he wants the Judicial Service Commission to know that he's living with the virus. In a way, it guaranteed he would get the position. And when he first acted on our court, it had been about 12 years ago, he was just beginning to get the first symptoms of active symptoms that you could see, and he started on the virus. And 3 years ago, he mentioned he was going on the Argus cycle tour around the Cape Peninsula. And I can tell you, if there's one thing you should not do, is look out for your friend with 30,000 people cycling past, because they're all whizzing by, they all look the same, they're all wearing their helmets, and it does something, a stroboscopic effect or something like that. And in any event, that was, he was doing that. But that was an example of a spectacular advantaged person, but there are people working in factories and working on farms and working as nurses and doctors and so on who are benefiting from the ARVs. And that's got a lot to do with the fact that treatment action campaign from the community was able to be the link between the community and the medical people. It's still high. It's the rate of new infections is coming down, and people are living much longer. And in terms of nevirapine, which was the case that we heard, when we heard the case, the cut in the transmission was about 50%. Now it's 95%. It's one of the most successful medical interventions that one could imagine. The currency the rand has gone up in relation to other currencies. It's come down again. It went up again, and now it's come down. That's compared to the dollar. Fortunately for me, I've never speculated in currency, and I'm earning something in dollars. So I've benefited a bit from that, but I think that happens to many countries. And then the percentage of people raped and murdered amongst the elderly. I think it's a rhetorical point that you're making. What I will say is it's far too many people, not just elderly people, young people, children. The big difference in South Africa now, I don't think it's worse than it was before. I think it's the silence has been broken. It's spoken about more. And in a very sad sense, the kinds of violence that were contained within one section of the population is now reaching out. That awful case of awful case, oh, we want to weep, Pistorius, the fantastic athlete, shooting his girlfriend dead, you know. It's too many guns. And he's saying as part of his defense, there are too many robberies, we'll have to see what it's all about. So you raise very, very legitimate areas of concern. What I can say, though, is these are not secret things. These are things our press speaks about, people speak about. One of the nice things in South Africa now, in fact, very nice things, is our biggest growth industry is stand-up comedians. And that laughter thing, people from all sections, you know, we can laugh at ourselves, and it's not just in a bitter, sardonic way. My family, my dad was Solly Sachs, my mother was Rachel Ginsburg. That gives you a bit of a clue. They came from Lithuania. My mom was 6 months, my dad about 6 years. He said, in Lithuania, if you fell in a river, you had to swim like hell. South Africa, you fall in a river and you get up and you dust yourself off. and their lives were hard. Very hard. My dad was in and out of school and never completed his school. He studied when he was older. He became the general secretary of the Garment Workers Union. And my mother worked for Moses Kotane. And she would say, tidy up, Uncle Moses is coming. But it wasn't Moses Goldberg. It was Moses Kotane. So I grew up in a home where my mom, and not only worked for him, but she had huge admiration and respect for him. So the issue of race for me wasn't tough at all. Maybe 90% of Jews in South Africa came from Lithuania, and they came with the stories of the pogroms, and they came, many of them, very, very poor, but with dreams of a better world. And I might say, when I was reading through the Bible, the parts that reached me were the whole period of Solomon, the Song of Songs, and embracing the whole world. Solomon married Ashiksa. but also the prophets. And it was tremendous reading the prophets. That was like consolation. And I think a lot of these ideas, the millenarian ideas, the ideas of internationalism, the ideas of a better world, just came with them in different ways. And I absorbed them, as I said, with my mother's milk and my dad's voice. Mandela, we want him to live forever. He's hanging in there. He's stubborn to the end. He's defiant.
Yeah.
And when I joined the Defiance Campaign, just four whites in Cape Town, 10,000 black people, the volunteer in chief was Nelson Mandela. It was the first time I really heard his name. And I've never met him, but we had that connection. And that was, in a way, how South Africans were linked. You were linked through struggle. So he is voluntarily going to jail in Johannesburg, and I'm voluntarily caught in jail, sitting on a bench marked non-whites only in Cape Town. And it's the struggle that's uniting us, not theoretical arguments about whites in a black struggle or black leadership. We just accepted there had to be black leadership. What's very moving for me now, when I was growing up, we heard all about civilization. The whites came to Africa to civilize Africa. And they brought the gallows, the death sentence. Our court abolished capital punishment. They brought the pass laws. They brought the indignities of people's life chances being determined solely on the basis of race. It wasn't exactly civilized the way I would like to think civilized means. And what Mandela is doing, when Mandela becomes the symbol of how human beings should be for the whole world, is an ache in the world for something that he represents. And it's dignity and its generosity and it's an embrace. And it makes me feel so proud that African man in our country is helping to civilize the world that sent all these ships out. And not through conquest, not through being more powerful, but through the force of example and what we call Ubuntu. I'm a person because you're a person. I can't separate my humanity without acknowledging your humanity. That's a new kind of civilization that's coming from Africa to the world. And for me, that's what Nelson Mandela represents. Julius Malema, I can't speak about him. Not because he's unspeakable. He's a candidate for the elections. He's going on trial quite soon. I'm a former judge. It would be inappropriate for me to comment. Because then it makes it look as though these judges have got their own political positions. They're going to speak in favor or against current candidates now. So I'm going to, you can call it duck that or evade that or simply plead the Fifth Amendment.
And put them together. And I'll just say real quickly, Julius Malema, for those who might not know, he's a firebrand sort of populist ANC youth leader. Although he's not that young.
Who was expelled? Huh?
Yeah, expelled now. But I mean, he had a following, and yeah. Theoretically still does. So, two questions together.
One right here. Thank you for being here, and thank you for every minute of your struggle. Having had the privilege to visit and study in South Africa, I was struck by the rawness and the freshness of the wound of racial injustice there, and the contrast between that and America, where we tend to talk of a post-racial society, and as though all of this is a healed wound. And what lessons do you have to share with us? It's very hard to, I guess, encapsulate, but for us to deal with this injustice that is more insidious these days. Thank you.
Reconciliation seemed to be a new concept, and we all heard about it. It doesn't seem like it's caught on. I was wondering if you might say why that might be and what are the criteria, what seeds have to be there for it to be replicated in another situation.
That's it. Okay. We used to talk about multiracial society, and then we felt that wasn't good enough because it still had separate groups. Then non-racial society, and that's in our constitution. In America, I'm hearing a lot about post-racial society. I don't see it.
Yeah.
race is still very, very strong here. You pick it up directly, indirectly, in all sorts of ways. I don't think it's right to say things haven't moved. They've moved. I've been coming to the States in the 70s, and I've seen lots of changes, and many of them are very much for the better. But I think the idea that you living in a post-racial society, I'd need a lot of persuasion. And our constitution and our courts are very clear. We need affirmative action in South Africa. Even the Democratic Alliance, which is the opposition party, is having huge debates. It was a founding principle of theirs to be a colorblind party, and now they're debating. And by and large, according to the press reports, the black members of the Democratic Alliance are saying, we've got to take account of race. It's a reality that's in our lives in the raw way that you mention. And if we don't, we're denying a lived reality. I think it's certainly in South Africa would be a total delusion to call us a post-racial society now, and a dangerous one. On the other hand, we can become too trapped in race and racial categories. There's some very, very progressive thinkers at Wits University in a body called WISER, and they're very strong on, we've got to transcend race, we've got to look for other forms of identity and communication. And I think they give an important counterpoint. But the point about a counterpoint is it's a counterpoint. The counterpoint doesn't take over the whole field. It doesn't abolish the thing that it's counterposing. So sadly, we're a long way away from that. Yet I've got a seven-year-old child, Oliver, the school he goes to now. It's just terrific to see the kids there. It's a local public school. And they're doing things together and playing together and they're active together. And it's just so kind of natural. When I took Oliver to the spot where I was blown up when we were making the film, I wanted him to see why his daddy's got one long arm and one short arm. And we sat there and I was speaking to him. And I could tell him about the bomb. And boom, and I was taken to hospital, and the doctors helped me very much, and they stopped me from being sore. And then I thought, can I tell him why? And I didn't want to tell him why. I didn't want to tell him that his mommy and I couldn't have lived together and couldn't have conceived him. I didn't want to tell him that this all happened in a world where people were fighting because of race. I wanted him to grow up in a world where he didn't see his mommy as one color and his dad of another color, mommy and daddy. And in that sense, we have moved ahead and he will learn. Somebody told him his daddy lost his arm fighting for freedom. Now, I didn't tell him that. I was very thrilled. I was very thrilled because fighting for freedom was good. He learned at a very early age that fighting for freedom is something worthwhile. And these are those things that MasterCard says money can't buy. And that thrilled me. So, and there are lots of kids like Oliver in our country. And it's great to see them. They came as clerks to our court. And our court itself was a little liberated zone in Johannesburg where I really felt this was a truly post-racial, if you like, institution, in its organization and composition and even in our ways of thinking. Reconciliation. If you can show me a country that doesn't have suppressed pain based on past injustice, then I'll show you a country that doesn't have scope for reconciliation. I don't think I'm sitting in that country right now. And it's how you deal with it. I think that's important. In Canada, this issue is very much on the agenda. And they've set up institutions. They're trying ways and means with some success, with less success. But to acknowledge the fact that the native Canadians, the indigenous people, were pushed off their land, they were subjected to disease, they were marginalized, their cultures were disrespected, and they acknowledged there was something wrong with that. And you're doing it not simply to rewrite the record, but to think, what does it do to our consciousness, our understanding, if we don't look at our history in a way that that's true? And I believe, and in Australia the same, when the Labor government, previous Labor government, some time ago, issued a public apology to the Aboriginal people, it didn't transform their lives. It was met with enormous response, because they're acknowledging there's something wrong. There's something wrong. I heard years back when President Clinton just apologized for the fact that African Americans were used in Tennessee, I think it was, prisoners for medical experiments. Just one tiny little thing in our whole history of, you know, you see the film now, this fantastic film, 12 Years a Slave, which, by the way, I didn't want to see. Who wants to go see a film with that title? And it's enthralling and very powerful. But compared to 12 Years a Slave, this was in some ways small. And yet, I understand it had a very strong response from people in the African-American community, because it was some bending of the knee. Here we are in California. I learned for the first time yesterday, I'm at Irvine, so people are very progressive there. And they're telling me about lynching. Lynching, I didn't know. Lynching to me was something that happened in the South. But there was more lynching here in California in the 30s and the 40s of the last century. It wasn't African Americans. It was Native Americans and people of Chinese origin. Others were being lynched. Thousands. Now, these are stories that somehow seep into the memories of surviving generations, but they're not told. The Mexican Latino population, we're in Los Angeles, but you'd never think L.A., you know, was ever a place that was settled by and developed by people of Mexican origin. And I think it's changing. And in that sense, Irvine is a great place to be in, because you see the vitality and the energy and the interaction of the students. The great majority now are of Asian and Latino origin, and it's terrific to be there. As a South African, I feel sort of very at home there, and if you like good food and you want any kind of Asian food at lunchtime, you can get Asian food with the Mexican tacos thrown in as well. So it's to say that the form that reconciliation takes is very country specific. There's some people demanding reparations. In South Africa, we did give some reparations through the Truth Commission. It wasn't enough. It was given grudgingly, it wasn't well handled. But to me, the real reparations are transforming the country, the homes, the education, the health. That's reparations, the dignity, the being able to walk through the cities with your head high, to feel that you belong and that you can dream and you can imagine things that couldn't happen before. That's the real deep repair. And we've made a lot of progress in that regard, but we still have a hell of a long way to go. I don't want to end with that phrase. What can I end with that's something nice?
Let's see.
Tell us another joke.
No, I'll sing you another song.
Sing the national
and this
anthem.
Is part of the Soft Vengeance story. I'm recovering in the London hospital and generally feeling very chipper, but I'd wake up at 4 in the morning. The painkillers have worn off and I'm alone. There's no nurses there. And then I would feel very alone. And I would sing a song that I'd learned from Paul Robeson. May I ask how many people in the audience know of Paul Robeson? Great, one would hope in a library like this.
We don't have to explain.
But I've asked elsewhere in America, and Paul Robeson was our Nelson Mandela, truly. He was such a hero in South Africa, and it had something to do with the posture and the dignity and reaching out to everybody. And the song was, I'd sing to myself, it's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's not my brother nor my sister, but it's me, O Lord. Now, when I tell this in South Africa, people join in. Standing in the need of prayer. It's not my brother nor my sister, but it's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. And let me just end then, if I may, with the Bobby who was mentioned by Henry, whom Henry had seen, was the person who sent me a note while I'm lying, recovering in hospital. Don't worry, Comrade Albie, we will avenge you. And I thought, we're going to cut off the arms, we're going to blind in one eye. Is that the country we're fighting for? And I said to myself, if we get democracy, if we get freedom, that will be my soft vengeance. And I heard some weeks later, I'm still in hospital, they caught the guy, have you heard the guy who put the bomb in your car? And I said, if he is put on trial and the evidence is insufficient to prove he's guilty and he's acquitted, that will be my soft vengeance, because then we're living under the rule of law. And I said, and then roses and lilies will grow out of my arm. The last time I looked, I didn't see any roses and lilies. But we've got a country. And for me, part of it is not just we've got a country. It's a validation of idealism. I think of all the Americans who stood by us and all believing apartheid was bad, they denounced apartheid, none of them believing we could ever really have a non-racial society. And we got it. We never got real. We refused to get real. We held out for the deep basic principles, and we got a country. And I think that's a good note on which to end.
I'll be back.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.